Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Gospel according to St. John in the 6th chapter, the verses 51 to 58. They're critical and crucial verses within the whole Bible. And yet, at the same time, they're very, very difficult to grasp and very, very difficult to understand in whatever is in the fullness of its meaning and its comprehension. It is during the discourse on the bread of life, but it's where Jesus becomes very graphic, and in his graphic nature, therefore creates a problem for among many, both to the audience that he speaks of at the time, but also to any contemporary audience that hears his words. It's very, very typical now when you hear the word of the Lord and it causes difficulty, it causes problems to understand it or interpret it. So you simply either dismiss it or change the meaning of it. This seems to be one of the favorite pastimes of the contemporary German church. But none of those things, neither of those alternatives are really helpful to us in grasping more deeply the meaning of the presence of Jesus Christ in the world and the presence of his word in our world today. So we'll start then with the gospel and then look and see if we can figure out maybe what it might mean for us in our prayer life, in our spiritual life, in our faith. Jesus said to the Jews, "I am the living bread come down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh for the life of the world." And then the Jews started arguing with one another. "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" they said. And Jesus replied, "I tell you most solemnly, if you do not eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will not have life in you. Anyone who does eat my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life. And I shall raise him up on the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. And he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood lives in me, and I live in him. As I, who am sent by the living Father, myself draw life from the Father, so whoever eats me will draw life from me. This is the bread come down from heaven, not like the bread our ancestors ate and died. But anyone who eats this bread will live forever." A very complicated text and a very difficult text, especially for us in the Western world. And its first problem, of course, showed up here in first century Palestine with those who were listening to them. Once again, to repeat, the Hebrew language, the ancient Hebrew language, is a very concrete language. It doesn't it doesn't even have comparatives in it. So we can say good, better, best. They can't say that. And their way of therefore using the comparative is through what they call hyperbola, through exaggeration. So we have to look for that exaggeration in the scriptures. Then we have to ask ourselves, well, if this is an easy dismissal, then maybe this is just hyperbola here in the gospel. But if it were hyperbola, then the Jews would have understood it as such, because it's their language, their culture, their time. But instead, they begin a discussion that has gone down into the present time. How can this man give us his flesh to eat? And so they raise then the question of cannibalism. And it's really interesting that as this whole idea of the Eucharist being the body and the blood of the Lord expands even into the Roman Empire, we find even in the ancient Roman author Tacitus a shaded accusation against the Christians in Rome of being cannibals, of eating human flesh, and so forth. Tacitus tends to call it their hatred of humanity, is what he called, but he inferred with it their cannibalism. There's also that it continues to be a part of our understanding of the Eucharist. I had a discussion not so long ago with a non-Catholic Christian who was enamored of the teachings of our church and our sacramental system, but said the one thing that he could not accept was our attachment to cannibalism in the Eucharist. So while in a way this sounds strange and foreign to us because it's not the thing that we first think about, nevertheless, it is a legitimate response if we take the whole thing out of context. And so that's why it's very important. Because of this accusation and because of this uneasiness about the sense of the Eucharist, many people have simply abandoned the idea of the real presence, and they kind of see it as a symbolic gathering or a symbolic presence, a symbolic sharing to form community, and all these kinds of things. And while it is certainly a sharing in community, it is not doing so in the modern sense of that word. It's not kind of a more serious extension of the ice cream social. It's not what it is. There is something very profound and very disturbing and very deep within this particular gospel. And so I think it's important for us to go back and to say to ourselves, what is Jesus talking about? And what did the disciples get from what he's saying? Because this discourse is very much an Old Testament discourse, very much a Jewish discourse, culturally so and linguistically so. Translated into Greek, Jesus does not use the word soma, meaning body, but he uses the word sarx, meaning flesh. And so he's talking about his own flesh. Now, it is true that in Aramaic, they refer to the whole person, perhaps, as sarx, but as the enfleshment of the human person. But there's something more profound here, and I think maybe we might want to take an excursion into the Old Testament so that we can find a context for this, so that we can find a way to understand this, which does not in any way diminish our belief in the real presence in the Eucharist, but it does put it into a biblical context so that we don't have to do mental gymnastics in order to try and explain that which ultimately is mysterious and inexplicable. The image goes back to the days of Abraham. And in the ancient Semite tradition, it was seen and understood that the seat of human life was blood, and the seat of all life. That's why they could not drink the blood of animals, and that's why, for instance, a properly butchered kosher animal, the blood is taken out, because it was seen as a life force and not just a material substance. And so if you consume the blood of animals, then you have animal life inside of you. So that they're very careful about that, and they're very cautious about that. And yet at the same time, they do understand that that blood as a life force is what makes the ancestor present within the descendant. We find that in the Jerome Biblical Commentary, it tells us that Abraham is Israel and Israel is Abraham. We know that flows from the covenant in which God promised Abraham, "Your descendants shall be as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea." And as he promises them this, as he says this to them, he understands it's easy for us to say, well, this is the way that they envisioned eternal life. Well, in a way it is, because as long as there's descendants, the life force of the ancestor is alive within the descendants, so that they have a certain identity with the ancestor. We find, for instance, in the Deuteronomy 26:6, in the Feast of the First Fruits, they take both the blood of Abraham, but the blood of Isaac and of Jacob, because it is Jacob's sons who go down into Egypt. And they say, "My father was a wandering Aramean in the desert." Well, that, of course, applies to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he went down into Egypt. Well, none of them went down into Egypt except at the very end as an old man. Jacob is taken down to see his son Joseph. And so he went down into Egypt, and there became a great people. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob became a great people. The person, the ancestor, is the people, because the blood of the ancestor flows in the life of the descendants, and therefore the life force of the ancestor exists and lives in the descendants who are in Egypt. Then the Lord brought us out with a mighty arm, and so forth. So what happens then, and we know these discussions between Jesus and the Pharisees in John's Gospel about, we are the children of Abraham, we are not slaves, and all of this. We are the sons. In other words, in a sense, we are Abraham, and therefore we are not slaves, we are free people, and so forth. So the identity of Israel becomes its descendancy from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as such, they become the presence of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the midst of the world. It's an interesting thing when Jesus is confronted by the Pharisees who tell the silly story about the woman who marries seven brothers and has no children. And then Jesus uses this against the Sadducees, who don't believe in the resurrection of the dead, and say, he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And that has two meanings to it. The one meaning is the eternal life. The second meaning is, and the Jews know this well, and the Sadducees know this well, that the ancestors exist in the people because their blood flows in the veins of the people. And therefore, they are bound to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And if they declare them dead, then they declare themselves dead as well. And so the Sadducees, of course, have no response to that. But we have to keep this in mind now when we go back and look at Jesus's bread of life discourses in the sixth chapter of John chapters, especially in these verses 51 to 58. Is it so that the Jews have some kind of cannibalistic tendency if they have the presence of the ancestor within them? No, it is not so. It is not how they think, and it is a deliberate distortion. They know what Jesus is saying. They know that he is forming a new people who are part of his life, his flesh, his sarks, his blood. And they react to that, and they disguise their reaction in the idea of we reject cannibalism. When we then look at that, and then Jesus pushes this even further, if he was concerned, if he knew that they were not disingenuous in what they were saying, he might have changed tactics, but he didn't. He says to you, I tell you most solemnly, if you do not eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will not have life in you. And anyone who does eat my flesh and drink my blood has eternal life. This can be seen, again, in two ways. That he himself, existing in those who partake of his flesh and blood, is eternally present in the world, and those who participate in his flesh and blood therefore live throughout the ages. The other idea, which is one more consistent, which where Jesus is going with all of this, is that this union with Christ is that which is fully realized in eternal life, in the resurrection of the dead. And so when we then go back and we look at whether it was the Passover meal or not, when we go back and we look at the Last Supper, what is Jesus doing? We know, for instance, that the whole Passover is people of Israel having within them the participants of the Exodus through the life force of blood, become present to the event of their deliverance. That's through word and through ritual. That's why they say, you say this, you do this. And when you say this and do this, you can become present to the events that you are participants in through your blood relationship with the ancestors. In that way, also, enter into the biblical studies the notion of time. There is There is a problem with our dealing with all of this in the New Testament, and it oftentimes really is not sufficiently considered. But it is the notion of what time is. Since the 12th century, with the coming of the Renaissance, Western humanity has changed the ancient notion of time. Before, it was always seen kind of as an entity, an existent thing. When we come now into the rationalization of the Renaissance, it becomes a unit of measurement. And so, a measurement of duration. But that's new, and that's revolutionary, and that's not part of the scriptural narrative. The scriptural narrative uses the idea of time as an existent reality. As an existent reality, we might be able to say, perhaps, that time is accumulative. It's like a snowball coming down a hill. It keeps gathering and gathering, but the core is still present. And if that image works for us, or if we simply say as an entity, what it is always is, then we are able to say to ourselves, well, therefore, in some strange way, shape, or form, the Exodus still exists in time. And that the patriarchs exist through the life force and the descendants also in time, so that the past is not forever gone, the future is not totally elusive, and the present is an ever-changing reality and phenomenon in our lives. When we look at this, then, and we say that through word and ritual, that in ancient Israel, the people could go back and visit the events of their deliverance through these words and rituals. They could, in a way, the word we use for that is anamnesis, the representation of the event. But more than the representation of the event is the presence of the participants' event to the original phenomenon locked in time, so that it is not dissipated, it does not go away. Then we can understand to a certain extent when Jesus is speaking to his disciples in this idea of the bread of life. If this is true, he is establishing a new reality in time that, because of the nature of its establishment, becomes timeless. So, when Jesus then takes the Passover ritual and the words and the events are intricately connected, and when he changes those, then he changes the reality of what he is doing. And when he says, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, and then turns to them at the supper and says, take this and eat of it, this is my body, take this and drink of it, this is my blood, it is the establishment of the new covenant. It is the establishment in flesh and blood, in sarx, in flesh and blood, of the new reality of the relationship of humanity to the living God. Now, the ancestor does not become Isaac, or Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. The ancestor now becomes the Son of God, so that the new blood that flows in the veins of the disciples is the divine element, is a divine element as well as in time the incarnational presence of Christ. So we pause for a moment and think about that. That's in some ways the problem is we have to go to all these lengths to explain something like this when to the disciples it was intuitive. It was very much a part of their lives. They knew exactly what Jesus was doing. They were perplexed by it. They didn't grasp the meaning of it. They didn't grasp the implication of it. But what they did grasp was that something dramatic was happening. And in that drama of what was happening, a new reality was being born. So that when they eat the flesh and they drink the blood of the Son of Man, the new ancestor now is inside of them. The life force of the incarnate Son of God is now present within them. And as such, he is them and they are him. In the same way that Israel is Abraham and Abraham is Israel. It's a very Semitic idea, and one that's just not that complicated except for us, because we don't have that sense of our relationality with the past, because time has been distorted by rationalism, and we don't have that sense of the presence of ancestral life within us, which is very much a part of almost all early cultures, of whatever stripe they might be. The Chinese, of course, developed the idea of ancestor worship. Certainly it was present within the Celtic tribes, and certainly present within the Semitic tribes of Israel. So that it is an ancient human intuition that defies rational explanation as a surface response to what's happening. We cannot simply take it on a shallow basis, because if we do, and if we use the rationalistic understanding of time, then it simply becomes a sign of something that is done and gone and far away. But when we take it in the biblical sense in which it was given to us, we understand that it pulls us into the mystery of the life of another person, into the mystery of the life of a people. And it is therefore the foundation of our whole understanding of community. Community is not a friendly gathering of like-minded people who celebrate each other in the presence of God. Community is a participation in the person of Christ, who is, in fact, the community of the saved, because he is within us. His flesh and his blood flow in our veins, are part and constitutive part of our being. The Eucharist, therefore, and when we find, you know, we hear the latest news, 75% of Catholics don't believe in the real presence of Christ. Part of it is because they have to take it as moderns take it, having no appreciation for ancestry and our connection and relationship to it, even though we are becoming incredibly interested in it and aware of it through the whole DNA process. Secondly, they have no understanding of the biblical notion of time. And so how can you make something that's long gone, over, dead, forgotten, now it's present again to us? You can't do that. Magic. It has to be magic to do something like that. Not so. But in the modern mindset, yes. How do you answer the question, if we do believe it is the flesh and the blood of the Lord, how do we answer the question from contemporary Christians who deny the real presence of the Eucharist? Well, then you're kind of celebrating cannibalism and kind of joining the ranks of Tacitus and here the disingenuous Jews who are distraught by what Jesus is saying. So is it understandable that they don't believe in it? Yeah, it is. It's understandable from the modern mindset. Is the modern mindset therefore inadequate to grasp and understand the full experience of the human person? Yeah, it is. It's very flat. It's very surface. It's very rational. It is, in a way, and I think I've used this before, for better or for worse, it's kind of an intellectual flat earth perspective of the reality of human existence and human life. There is nothing beyond the surface, and all of the surface can be managed and manipulated if we just get powerful enough and if we just play the political game long enough. That solves nothing, because it changes with the changing perceptions of the intellectual flat earth life. We have found that the gift that the ancient world can give to us is not ruined monuments and strange epics of any kind. It gives us a sense of the human being, gives us a sense of the human person. It gives us a sense of the meaning of human existence on earth. That's what the ancient world can give to us. It is articulated in relationship to the living God in the Hebrew Scriptures. It is contained in the relationship, in the understanding and sense, more sense of the relationship of Abraham to the people of Israel. And it is incorporated into the Eucharistic narratives of the New Testament, and particularly graphically so in the Gospel of St. John, where Jesus makes it very clear that he is replacing the Abrahamic patriarchy with the patriarchy, and I know that's a bad word for some people, but it has a positive meaning also, that with the patriarchy or the sovereignty presence of the living God constantly within the very visceral existence of human persons, so that faith becomes a relationship with the God-man and not simply an acquisition to intellectual propositions. Those help us to clarify our thought and they keep us from going astray. But the fundamental reality down deep inside is that through our union with Jesus Christ, we actively share the events of our redemption, the crucifixion, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. It is something we need to reflect upon and pray over, because it does not come naturally into our language, into our modern understanding of reality. It defies being a flat earth concept. It has a depth that goes back from the very ancient days of humanity and back into the infinity and the eternity of the living God. It is something which draws us out of ourselves and into something larger and greater than ourselves. And that larger and greater than ourselves is the incarnate Son of God. Sharing his body and blood, we share also his soul, his divinity, his body, his blood. It is the process of the divinization of humanity, which is the prelude to eternal life. When we, I don't know how we can reflect upon this in any kind of simple way, but actually, if we stop and think about this, it isn't that complicated. It really isn't. And there's little concrete ways in which this can become present to us in such a way that we don't have to get into mental or intellectual gymnastics to understand that Jesus has made himself a part of our flesh and we a part of his flesh and his spirit, not only now, but for all eternity. And this is the avenue, the way, the truth, the life. This is what takes us into the eternal presence of the living God.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. There